But we can, you can ask questions as we go along. I have 35 minutes, and in reality, I have far fewer slides, but my intent is to go back and give some examples of what we discussed. And what I'm planning on doing is defining what translational research is for public health informatics. There's really good guidance out there on what it is for the National Cancer Institute. And I'm going to use that as a starting point and then deviate from that to show how it applies to public health and informatics. And on the National Cancer Institute website, there's some really neat material, and one of them is the definition for translational research. And it's basically, you know, scientific studies that come out of the clinic, the lab, and population studies that are applied to development of new tools and applications that then come back to support, you know, reduced mortality and morbidity. And this is slick, and this really needs to apply to many different domains, not just in cancer. And also on this website is this thing called a continuum, where there are five stages to translational research. And I'm not going to go through these in detail, other than to take that and then try to make that fit into what public health informatics is and see how it compares and contrasts and how we can learn from this and then maybe define a new way of doing translational research that has a lot of benefit to those populations. So what I wanted to do is go back to what a definition may be of public health informatics. And this came from Yasnov and many others, and it's really the application of information and computer science to public health practice. And if one would want to define what translational research may be, it would be, you know, is the conversion of these advancements in to really to support public health practice. And the key on the bottom here, and Dr. Frieden pointed this out the first day, and we feel fairly strongly, is that it research for research sake doesn't make sense unless it supports public health practice, if you're doing it for public health informatics. So we've actually come up with what we think might be a more suitable definition, because translational research for public health informatics just isn't about computers and IT. It really crosses many disciplines. It crosses epidemiology, you know, biostatistics, math, a lot of disciplines, and information technology. So we really think information technology for information technology by itself isn't the goal. It's how do these intersection of these technologies used in conjunction with advanced tools support you know, public health practice. So that's kind of where I'm taking off in changing things slightly. What we've done is we've added one stage to the continuum, and it's called this public health requirement piece. And this requirement piece could either be, you know, before the basic science discovery, if you're funding basic science discovery for a specific application, or it could be pulling from things that have occurred in scientific discovery in other areas. But with knowing what the goal is, that the goal is the end game at the end, that you really want to produce something that has value. And so I'm going to walk through each one of these stages, give some examples, and maybe come back if we have a lot of time and talk about our personal experience and how to make this happen. So basic discovery can occur in a whole variety of different disciplines, and it just doesn't have to be in information technology and computer science. It can occur in physics or other things, and if it's something that can be used, that's the key. There are 10 basic missions for public health, and those missions are to some extent define what some of the requirements would be. Our focus at Johns Hopkins APL is trying to support the disease surveillance and outbreak management component with information technology. But there are many other things that fit. But these form a filter up front. You know, if you've got some neat whiz-bang thing, but if it doesn't fit into one of these requirements, then, you know, maybe you really shouldn't think about it too much further. The early translation stage is something that systems engineers call conceptual development. and that is really finding partners who might be your early adopters of technology, seeing what fits into their business practices. If it doesn't work for them, even though it's a neat idea, and it won't work in the long run, and it's not sustainable, it maybe you shouldn't go much further. So this is another stage that really, when you come out of this stage, you have a very good concept of how this would be eventually be applied in the adoption stage. The next stage, which is called late translation or prototype development, is really going through this process with the collaborators that you've formed in your early translation stage with your partners, and trying to find out what works for them in trying to develop a prototype. You may need to do some type of retrospective evaluation with data that you've collected. If it's a real-time system where you need to do prospective analysis, you need to do that as well. And those are all part of the process of trying to get an application together that makes sense and works for the community. Once you've done that, then you need to share that knowledge with the community. And this can be done through publications. It can be done through the FIN conference. It can be done through open sourcing the application and getting feedback. It can be done through communities of practice, blogs, a whole variety of things. But the information has to get out there and get information back from others who've had similar experiences or who know something that you may not have encountered when you've gone through this process. The adoption phase is actually where you can get maybe one of the federal agencies or local state health departments to adopt your application into its business practices. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I didn't mean to
interrupt. Yeah, no, let's go ahead. Yeah. Yeah, so the thought, and I guess I shouldn't walk away from the microphone, but the thought is that in those mission needs for public health, with the stresses of globalization and everything else that's occurring, there's definitely a need to have new technology to support that. I mean, budgets for health departments are going down. You don't have increased people to work on things. I mean, technology becomes a something that enables you to continue to do your job that's becoming more stressful now. So that requirement, for that piece of technology, in order to define that requirement, you really need to have some linkage with some public health agency. And so the requirement in the early translation stage, they blend together a little bit, because you need to have that communication and that information flow to know what makes sense. If there's a new way to display an enormous amount of information that you might see in an electronic health record, how does this help public health? It may help clinical side, but it may not help public health. And if this is public health informatics, it may help public health because public health can glean a lot of information. They need to summarize it. So there's this. All of these are, I don't know if I answered your question correctly or not.
You are, in a sense, my background is IT, but I generally look to trying to develop a thorough understanding of requirements before considering technology, because there's often a mistake of leaping on a technology.
Yeah, so what you're saying is correct. That the requirement can come before basic discovery, or it can come after. It depends where what is included in this research piece. So there can be research that's out there done by others that's in the literature that you can pull from to try to figure out what is a good solution for your requirement, or you can say, I need to do additional research based on this requirement. So in that case, some of these might be flipped around, and one could easily say that the technology requirement or the public health requirement could be the first stage, but it's all a function of where you're pulling from and things like that. But that's exactly correct. I don't know if that's answering the question or not.
And I understand the conceptual framework.
Yeah.
And
yeah. So what I was trying to do is I was trying to get this to fit into the National Cancer Institute's and see how it might be modified for public health informatics. And I added that one piece, but that might be the overarching driver that drives the whole thing up front. So I just put it on the chart the way I did, but in reality, that's such a great motivator that I had to stick it somewhere, so for convenience sake, I stuck it there. So going back to the last piece on the adoption side, once it's adopted, there's all kinds of discovery that you make after you start using an application. And you learn so much by doing things in real practice rather than in the earlier stages where you're trying to evaluate something. So then there's knowledge sharing, and there might even be new requirements. And in reality, there's feedback to all the other stages. There's a lot of feedback that may go back in the dissemination of the information of what you've learned. But you may go back to each one of the stages. And there may actually be a new requirement that might be based out of what's been learned, or a new need for some new, you know, scientific discovery, like a new very low power or something to collect data, or a need to go back and further investigate it. So this is kind of where we're at. What I had in the original presentation was our example of how we've done this in essence. But there are many examples of good translational research where things have gotten into adoption. And what I'll do is I'll maybe walk through some of these. We'll see how much time we have, and then I can come back and talk about it. I'm really fortunate to have Dr. Diane Matusik in the back of the room, who helped us move through this process when she was at the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. She was one of the county health officers. So maybe she can add. So if you've ever gone to Finn or worked with CDC, you know about EpiInfo. And I love this because this is a gorgeous example of a tool that gets widely applied, and I can't speak to it as knowledgeably as I should, but they've really done an excellent job of it. And it's multilingual. It's all kinds of neat things. They make sure that it's compatible with a whole variety of different standards. I mean, there's even now an open EPI version that's looked at, and CDC does a real good job of marketing things. Lori Hutt-Wagner's done a great job with yours. I don't know if you sat in the announcement. The Davis Awards were Boston's used years. NC Detect, the basis of NC Detect has been years in other applications as well. Health Map, you know, John Brownstein's Health Map is getting a lot of visibility right now. Google bought the rights to it and are pushing it. I mean, that's a way to get it out there. And then I'll talk a little bit about our essence, but what I'm going to do is if I can back up, I'll back up and show how that, oh, I can't, well, I'll start from back up and show how some of this worked in at least our area. And then please feel free to ask questions. So how did we get involved in this piece? And I was very fortunate to have worked with the Maryland Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. Specifically, we got involved in this with Dr. Georges Benjamin, who said there was a need for technology. You're a technology organization. So we had a dance for a couple of years where we walked back and forth between what requirements may be for a system and what was needed by the state. And at that time, he was very concerned about bioterrorism. He was very concerned about Y2K and the fact that computer systems may go down. We may not know what's going on. And so we were very, very fortunate to find funding from the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, who at the time were saying, well, you know, terrorism's kind of becoming an interesting thing. You know, we'll give you a small amount of money to see if you can do a pilot, but we really don't think you can get health data to do any type of surveillance. So for Y2K, we did a disease surveillance system within Maryland that demonstrated, because right after, if you recall, right after Y2K, there was a huge influenza outbreak in Maryland, and we could differentiate and find things that were going on in the background while this influenza was occurring. That kind of stimulated interest, and we got additional funding from a variety of different places. And DARPA actually then had a full-fledged program in doing research. But then 9/11 hit, and we were very fortunate in the fact that now it's become almost a requirement that there be some type of surveillance for diseases that could proliferate fairly quickly. So that kind of moved us through this continuum fairly quickly and into the adoption phase. But I think what it did was it really left us without really doing a good job in some of these phases that were in between, like the late translation phase where we're doing a lot of evaluation. New York City Health Department had their system out. ROS was putting a system out. BioSense came substantially later. And BioSense said, well, we've seen what others done, we can do it better, you know. And so they moved out. Syndromic surveillance was born, I guess. The ISDS Society was initially grew out of a conference that was held up in Bethesda that the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research funded and brought people together. Then there was the National Syndromic Surveillance Conference that Farzad Mustashari hosted up at the New York Academy of Medicine, and that turned into the ISDS and the annual conference. So a big piece of this is dissemination and sharing the knowledge. And I had a slide that I had in a previous version of this presentation that showed how many of these applications, the ones that are really out there in the community, are in conferences like FIN, in conferences like ISDS or AMIA. You can count those applications that have been accepted by the community, and you can see how they've been adopted and how those users are actually, not the developers, but how the users are actually taking that information and feeding it back to their community of practice. I actually moderated a session on Monday with state health departments where they were looking to open source solutions, and they were looking to share information among state health departments and how they came up with capabilities to share knowledge and how they became FIN-MS compliant and how they worked through a lot of their, and I thought that was an amazing session because here are all the states getting together and said, this is how I do it. How do you do it? Can we share something? And, you know, there's really cheap alternatives to spending a lot of money with vendors because now there's open source. So if you do it smartly, there's nothing free. There's nothing free in open source because you have to apply it and use it wisely. But if you do it smartly, you can save a ton of money, and you can resolve some of the problems that you have with low budgets and things like that. So I don't know. I'm probably way early, but I'd love to take questions. This is basically a systems engineering process. I'm an engineer, and because of that, I look at it from a different perspective than maybe a public health worker. But this is a process that I think is very, very valuable in not only developing an informatics application, but in many applications. But the key is the requirement and the adoption, and I think if you keep those, you know, in the forefront of every project you do, I think then you have a winner. So I've got 15 minutes for questions if anybody's interested at all, and I'm willing to entertain questions on this or on any other aspect of essence or disease surveillance, or maybe people can tell me what's going on with NICFI. Which grid technology? Last year at this conference, we put a lot of energy into showing how you could use a whole bunch of different services into creating an application that might be viable. And what we picked was a disease surveillance application. So we put out services that did analytics. Matter of fact, we have an analytics grid service on NICFI's grid right now. We have a data service. We synthesize data for people who want to do research. So the grid is unique in the fact that it's like a community of practice where there's, you know who your users are, and potentially that's the way it's supposed to work. It's very highly secure, and you can get access to things if you're in that community. In some ways, it's very similar to web services, but web services is open. So if you want to use Google Maps and you're using your disease surveillance, you're sending your data to Google, and they got it, you know. And so what do you do? They've got your data now, and maybe you don't want to share your data in that type of environment. There are solutions that people have come up with for the grid that will allow you to maintain the privacy of your information while at least having all of those services available. So what I think the beauty of the grid is that as long as you can maintain those services, those organizations that put services on the grid, if they can update it so that you have, if you're a health department and you're looking for the latest and greatest because now I have a health risk, and I need to know something about something, I need to put an application together that uses this, this, and this. If it's out there on the grid and I can grab it and do it, that has potential value to me because there's very little that I need to invest to go out and grab everything. Now, you need to know how to do that, but hopefully if you have a savvy IT department, you can do that. So there's a learning curve, and how long it's going to take for it to become real valuable to public health is another question. I'm not sure that you're going to find too many health departments jump in with both feet at this point in time. I do feel the research needs to go forward in that concept because I do think it provides solutions for some of the problems that are currently being faced with sustainability. I mean, you have H1N1 and you want to change an application. Well, that takes $10 million in 2 years. Well, I need it now, you know, and it's not going to happen now unless I can come up with the budget and put a, you know, program together. If there is a solution for something that you can access via the grid, you know, in the future, not right now, then I think it is a viable option. I don't know if that's the correct answer. We can throw this open to discussion, you know, around the room. But from that viewpoint, I think it has a lot of value. But it's not there here and now. It's got a ways to go to have value to public health, I think. Well, 10 more minutes. I have to stay up here. So okay. Okay, so this isn't necessarily have to be in the public domain. I mean, you can have an application behind a health department's firewall. You know, the thread of how one goes about to develop that application, you don't have to open source it. I mean, that's a solution. I think disseminating the knowledge makes a lot of sense. In our application Essence, we're just starting to get to open Essence. You know, Essence is an application that sits behind health department firewalls. It's not something, we're not an application service provider like RODS is or like BioSense is to a great extent. It's a local application, but the knowledge has been disseminated, and it's an application that's widely available to health departments. You know, it's not a, we're not a vendor, so we just supply it because the government's already paid for it. This process, I think, works for any type of application, whether or not it's a unique application that a specific health department has a need for, or it's something that's used by the wider community. I think going through and trying to understand the requirements, and then you know, finding who the right partner is. You know, maybe you already have the partner, because maybe you start, you know, if you're a vendor, then you start with that partner. But you still need to really understand the requirements fairly, and you still need to understand the business practices. Otherwise, the application may not be sustainable. I've been involved with several health departments who've built large applications, but they never really went into adoption because they failed somewhere along the way, either because there wasn't enough money or there wasn't really good expectation as to what the requirements were. You know, there were requirements creep, so there were we want more, and they weren't. And it's not just the vendor's fault, but a lot of time vendors, you know, lowball things so they can win something as well, and you know, that's not fair on their part, but it's also not fair on public health side to change requirements and then make it more difficult. So I think going through each one of these stages, hopefully there's a good understanding of, you know, these are the things and this is what's being delivered, and if we don't do that, if it doesn't fit in your business practices, then you know, and if it's a, you know, if you need $10 million a year to operate that application, well, you know, we really need to know that up front, because maybe this doesn't work in the long run and we're destined to failure. So so I've got several more minutes, right?
Yeah.
So you have a question? Yes. I missed the last piece of. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's a really good question, because I think it can occur at a lot of different stages. Obviously, it can't occur real early in a stage before you have a prototype. But I think in the concept development stage, it's pretty easy to determine whether or not you're building momentum. I think, you know, after, you know, the late translation stage, or where you've got the prototype and you've done some evaluation, you know, I think there's a really good point there you can determine whether or not there's value, but whether or not it's sustainable in the adoption phase, you may not know until you get to the adoption phase. So you can, I think if you can't find value in at least the last three stages of the continuum, then something's probably not right. Because at some point in time, one has to say, you know, yeah, I've gone down this seemed like a great idea, but maybe we should end it here, because I don't see it ever being a sustainable application, and we really need an application like that. So you're right, there's a decision process that isn't included in this, and that's a very good observation that has to be made based on where the value is. That's a very good question. Got five more minutes. Well, I could do a dance. I didn't dance last night.
I had a question about the collaboration between public and private. I think it's kind of related to the question was earlier. But when you're using the continuum to make a decision as to where you do the dissemination and the adoption, so you've already discovered the basic science, you've already put together, you know, the technology and the tools, your vendor selection. You've already taken it through the health agencies and actually looked at business practices from the private sector as well as from the public health sector. There seems to be a barrier, but obviously for a long time there's been a barrier between the two, and we've been trying to transcend this for quite some time. But from a vendor's perspective, we can kind of look at that from a top perspective and say, okay, let's build a bridge between this. So you get into the late translation phase, into the adoption phase, but whenever there's a cost association factor, then that kind of excludes the public health market. How do we get past that barrier?
You know, I think in some of these earlier phases, I think there really needs to be a really good recognition that you can't get something for nothing. You know, and even open source costs, you know, even if, you know, you could pull everything down and download it off the internet that you needed. You still have FTEs that have to run and operate this thing. And, I mean, does it perfectly match your solution? So that realization has to be made up front. One of the very stressful things that I've been involved in development of the Essence system is we've had a lot of these prototype, you know, activities. You know, we with the DOD after 9/11, they had this thing called the Joint Surveillance Installation Pilot Project, where we helped merge public health with DOD facilities, preventive medicine, and hadn't worked as a unit because in a lot of cases, the local health departments don't know what's going on in that military base. In a military base, you know, they see the patients and, you know, the active duty and the dependents, but they don't know what's going on around them. So we brought them together, and it seemed like it was a really great pilot and everything. Well, then it's over with. You know, well, you've got all these people together, and they started this. They love it. And you say, well, there's no sustainability. We did the pilot. You know, this is now everybody's got to pick it up and run with it on their own. Well, that's really not fair. And there's so many programs out there, you know, that do that, that for those people who buy into it and say this is great and who try to make it work, you know, that's the health departments, the hospitals, you know, the vendors, everybody. It just doesn't seem to be the right way to go to say, okay, it's chopped off, it's ended, now it's somebody else's problem. Yeah, and I think that's I'm not sure how we overcome that, because, you know, there's changes in administration, there's changes in thought, you know, there's, you know, but somehow there needs to be sustainability of some of these applications. That's why I like EpiInfo, because CDC at least is, they're backing it, they're always there to improve it and do something, because they see the value to, but not all applications, not all programs are like that. That, I mean, the realization that that can happen, it has to be up front. And but you're right, that's I think that's a major impediment to moving.
That generally seems to be the rule of thumb, is the adoption by the CDC, so that they continue the continuum of the funding. But whenever it comes to verticals such as, or I guess that's a vendor term, verticals, but such as your cancer registries and such as your asthma registries and things like that, it's a little bit harder to get buy-in from an entity like that for dissemination.
The states pick that up because they recognize it. I mean, it. And that's, I think in some states it's easy to pick that up because they have such a big, Maryland has a huge problem with, you know, lung cancer and things. So, you know, Diane could probably talk to that, but she's gone. She didn't want to talk to it. But they have a really good registry. But you're right. Some of these things are major, major issues. That, how do you sustain something, you know? Because you need that to move forward. So I'll probably get down and let the next person know.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody, for putting up with me.